from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Ann Packer is the author of two best-selling novels, The Dive from Clawson's Pier and Songs Without Words. Her new book is called Swim Back to Me. It's a collection of short stories that provide further testimony to Packer's uncanny ability to capture a moment, a scene, a bit of dialogue with pinpoint accuracy. You read a passage and you say to yourself, that's true, or perhaps more often, ouch, that's true. Her stories are about longing and loss, about love and loyalty, and what lingers beneath the surface of each. Ann Packer joins us to talk about her new book, Swim Back to Me, next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. A New York Times reviewer once noted that the novelist Ann Packer had an unerring ear for dialogue. That gift is on display once again in her new book, Swim Back to Me, a collection of stories in which Packer captures the voice of a 14-year-old as uncannily as she does a grieving mother or a self-satisfied English professor. Packer's stories are often about life's most challenging moments, the acute confusion of adolescence, that moment when your hopes for a relationship come tumbling down, or the ravages of grief when a parent loses a child. But the stories also remind you that you only feel loss if you've loved first, that indeed love and loss are inextricably connected. What there is to gain, one of her characters observes, is exactly equal to what there is to lose. Ann Packer writes about characters who stand on the precipice of making that bargain and those who are trying to survive having made it. Her previous books include the best-selling novels The Dive from Clawson's Pier and Songs Without Words. The new collection of stories is called Swim Back to Me. Ann Packer, good morning.
Good morning.
It's a pleasure to have you here. In a review of your new book from the San Francisco Chronicle, the writer Joan Frank writes, "Her prose is so simple and direct that it has a scrubbed clean quality, and her patient investigations reveal human longing in such clear, stripped-down familiarity that readers experience a singular sense of comfort." I thought it was a really interesting observation because that's what always strikes me about your writing as well, that it's so observational, it's so precise and detailed in the way in which it invokes something that rings true to people. So I have this image of you walking around with a notebook, sort of writing down everything that you observe. Is that right?
No, not at all. I'm one of the few writers, I think, who has really never had a notebook of any kind, never wrote a journal as a kid. The interesting thing for me as a writer about detail is that it is so crucial to make the reader believe in the world. Detail is really central to that. On the other hand, if you go a little too far, then the piece becomes about the details. Hmm. So it's really a balancing act of the sights and sounds and smells and feels, but not too much of them.
It reminds me what you just said of a passage in one of the stories called Dwell Time, where a woman is wondering where her husband is, who's late and hasn't come home yet, and she's getting increasingly anxious about that. But there's a little detail about the kitchen smelled of tomatoes and cheese or something. I can't remember exactly which ingredients now. But it was that little element that made it feel real to me, because you do take that in. You take in what's cooking in the kitchen at the same time your body is telling you that you're incredibly anxious.
Yeah, it's funny. I was looking at that story recently, trying to decide what to read at a bookstore event, and my eye fell onto that exact phrase, the kitchen smelled of tomato and melted cheese. She's making enchiladas. And I had this feeling of, is that a little too kitcheny? Is that a little too homey? So it's really nice to have you say that for you, in a way, it clinched the realism.
No, I think that's where you believe it, in a way. The review talks about that readers experience a singular sense of comfort. I don't know if it's comfort for me, at least, because sometimes for me it was more like, ouch, because it has this sense of like, oh, yeah, I know what that's about.
Well, I was struck by that line in the review as well, the idea that readers experience comfort. And I think maybe what she meant was the comfort of the familiar, the kind of ability to recognize life being lived in a way that resembles the way you live your life. That's just a guess, but I kind of went there in my reading of the review.
Ann Packer is our guest this hour. Her new collection of stories is called Swim Back to Me. She'll be at a series of appearances coming up, by the way, a couple coming up this weekend, Saturday. She'll be on West Coast Live, which is at the ODC Theater on 17th Street in San Francisco. And then Sunday, April the 17th at 6 o'clock, she'll be at Books, Inc. on 4th Street in Berkeley. The story, the collection of stories is framed by two stories, the first of which is a long short story, novella, I guess, 100 pages or so, called Walk for Mankind. And in that story, you climb into the characters of two eighth graders, 13 and 14 years old. I want to just read this one little phrase from the beginning of the story, because, again, it's about this question, to me at least, of sort of getting the details and the specificity of a character. This is the character Sasha, who is meeting this boy who becomes her friend for the first time. And she says to him, "I was waiting for you to come over, but it's just as well we met like this, because if you'd come over, I'd probably been a freak. Plus, my parents would have co-opted the whole thing." Do your parents co-opt everything? I mean, it sounded to me, as best I remember, exactly like a 14-year-old.
Well, I hope so. I'm not sure if I'm remembering my life as a 14-year-old or in some way drawing on the 14-year-olds I've known most recently, which would be my kids and their friends. It's a lot of fun, I think, writing teenage characters. I had a teenager in my last book, a pretty unhappy teenager. But it's such a important moment in life with the possibility of self-definition sort of right ahead of you. And teenagers have to make so many choices about how they're going to behave, how they're going to sound, how they're going to look, who they're going to be. It's a lot of fun to write about them.
It's that moment when you first discover so many things or experience so many things for the first time, whether that's love or loss or faith comes tumbling down or whatever it is, but there's an intensity about that time.
Right. And you also discover that your experience is just your experience, that your experience of the world is not the same as everyone else's. I think, you know, up until maybe 12 years old or so, we believe that family life is our family life and can't really conceive of parents who behave differently from our parents, different kinds of sibling relationships. And then we start going out into the world and discover that, well, as Sasha says, you know, she'd have probably been a freak or her family would have been a freak. And you don't expect that, really.
Tell us something about that story. It's called Walk for Mankind, that begins the collection of entitled Swim Back for Me, Swim Back to Me, rather. What drew you to telling that story? What were the origins of that story?
That story, the material of that story has actually been with me for 15 years or more. And it's funny. It was one of those things where I had some of the characters. I had Sasha and her family. And, you know, as the story progresses, you really get to know her parents very, very well. They're important figures in the story. I knew that they were people who had newly come to Stanford, where my protagonist lived, and that it was going to be about what happened to my protagonist as this family got sort of bigger and bigger. Took up more space. When I first was writing it, I thought that the narrator, the point of view character, was a girl. And it was going to be this friendship between these two 13-year-old girls. And I couldn't really get anywhere with it. And I set it aside for a long time. And then I had one of those, you know, great light bulb moments where I thought, maybe all of this is happening to a teenage boy. And of course, that introduced all kinds of new elements, new possibilities, and it progressed pretty readily from that point.
How much of those sorts of experiences, that story in particular, comes from your own life experience? Because you came, I think, right, to Stanford at about that same time, no?
I was actually born at Stanford and lived in the faculty, quote-unquote, ghetto my whole life. As far as life experience, I think I was drawing on a feeling of what Stanford and Palo Alto were like in the early 70s, somewhat what some of my friendships felt like in the broadest sense. But the actual events of the story, well, I did go on a walk for mankind. I did go on two walks for mankind. But the sort of important interpersonal events of the story are, you know, entirely fictional.
So where does that come from? Where does that invention, that gift of imagination to come forward in that story, where does that come from, if not from personal experience?
It comes from the part of personal experience that you're not actually processing in your conscious mind, I think. I mean, I think one of your guests in the previous hour was talking about writing from the unconscious. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember exactly what he said, but my thought was, what other way is there? Sort of. I don't plan a lot. I sit at the computer. Sometimes I really have no idea where my next sentence is coming from or going to. But I think one of the nice things about doing this for a while is that you can live with not knowing more easily, and also give yourself the opportunity to explore what seems like a really stupid idea and find out that there's something to it.
Writers often say that they don't know how a story is going to turn out, and it always seems sort of unbelievable to me. But I guess it must be so. I mean, is that really right that as you are writing the story, you don't know how it's going to turn out, how it's going to end? And is that then important to giving a reader something that you would want a reader to have, which is wondering how it's all going to turn out?
It depends on the piece. With my work, I would say maybe half of the time I have a general sense of where it's going to go. With both my novels, I knew sort of what the emotional landing point was going to be. I didn't know exactly what was going to happen to get the characters there, but I had a sense of a shape. With some of the stories in this book, I really had no idea. But the thing is, you're making that, I won't say discovery, you're inventing the series of scenes and recollections that propel the reader to the end. But then once you've done it the first time, then you go back, you revise, and I think that's where you do the work that makes the reader's experience as suspenseful as it needs to be for the particular piece of fiction.
Ann Packer again, our guest this morning. Her new collection of stories is called Swim Back to Me. A lot of the stories are about loss and about the moment when something sort of comes apart in various ways, whether that's a moment of grief or a moment where a relationship doesn't turn out the way you want it to. Is that something that you find yourself drawn to?
It seems to be. You know, they say if there isn't a problem, there isn't a story. And for whatever reason, that problem of loss or change, certain kinds of change aren't exactly changes that involve losing something, but they can call up a similar intensity of emotion. That's what I go to. You know, it's not like I think, what can I write about loss today? You know, it starts with character, situation, setting, and then it moves thematically by a, as I said, sort of an unconscious process.
There's a line that ends one of the stories called Jump that's about several different characters who are in different ways are trying to leave something behind and move on. And the last sentence in that story is, wanting to be gone was one thing, but going was another. And it struck me that that line actually could have appeared in several of the stories, that it's about – because you have – in another story, it's about a husband who winds up sort of leaving his wife, and it's about wanting to go, but going is another. Similarly with the title, the principal story, Walk for Mankind. Is that – where does that – I'm just curious about where that comes from, Anne, that sense of – do you think that's something that people or your characters struggle with in particular, wanting to be gone, but then actually going is something else?
Well, I think I would go a little wider and say that what my characters, people, whatever, I think what we struggle with all the time is conflicting desires. So wanting to be gone and not going includes something else, which is wanting to stay. So there's there's that conflict that we live with, and you know, one side will ascend, and then the other side will ascend, and you know, that's called living life in a way. I do think that in a book that is largely about relationships in one kind of trouble or another, the characters' desires to get away from each other do predominate.
How did you work with the idea of how these would fit together? Obviously different to do a collection of a half a dozen different stories versus a novel, but they do fit. Is that conscious to have a kind of central struggle, like wanting to be gone, that ties them together? How did you try to conceive of this as a collection that wasn't – because it doesn't appear to be random. It wasn't like, oh, well, we'll just put this together and it'll be a collection of short stories.
Well, honestly, it was the stories I had. I guess I have a few stories slash sort of uncategorizable pieces of writing that would not have worked in this book. Less because of their themes than their forms, which depart from the kind of realism that characterizes the stories in this book. As I was thinking about a book as opposed to a series of stories that I was writing, what I really wanted to do was come around by the end of the book so that there was a feeling for the reader of something familiar happening at the end that tied back to the beginning. And so the novella that we were talking about before, Walk for Mankind, that is about Sasha and the boy Richard, provides some of the characters for the last story, Things Said or Done, except for that by then Sasha is in her 50s and her relationship with her father, who, as I said before, becomes an important character in Walk for Mankind, is the center of the story.
And was that something that you had conceived of all along, this idea of framing the book with this opening novella and then coming back to it at the end?
Pretty much so. I didn't know exactly what was going to provide the setting or plot for the last story. I didn't know exactly which of the characters from the novella would appear in that story, but I did know that it was going to revisit some of those people.
It's interesting. I didn't know as I began that last story that it would have those characters, that it was framed in that way. But very quickly, I knew that it was Sasha, that it was an older Sasha, but I knew it was Sasha just by the way she says one sort of flip thing back to her father. And there is that sense of familiarity. And part of what intrigued me about those characters at the end of that book is that you can tell Sasha, and I think you write at one point, that she's exhausted by her father. And yet they're also so tied. They so fit together in a way that she does not with her mother, who is an easier person to be around. But there's something about Sasha and her father that, as painful, exhausting, frustrating, maddening as that relationship it is, they're also joined at the hip.
Yeah, they're enmeshed. They really are. And the idea of wanting to leave but not going certainly applies in this situation. She's a 51-year-old woman who was briefly married in her 20s and who's at this point in her life, her central relationship is with this cantankerous, difficult, charming, obnoxious man. And that's, I think, how it's going to be for her until he's gone.
And there's a little detail in that that you tell. I wonder if you'd tell this story that has to do with a cake. That's a story from their earlier, much earlier in life. But her dad gets it and her mom doesn't.
Right. She's remembering the story takes place at a wedding. It's at her younger brother's wedding. And she's there with her elderly father and her elderly mother comes in separately, but then is there with them also. And she and her father start laughing at something together. And the laughter reminds her of something they used to say to each other to make the other sort of, you know, collapsing giggles, which refers to an evening that the family spent in San Francisco shortly after they arrived in California. And the four of them were outside a French restaurant one evening, and a well-dressed couple comes out of the restaurant and starts to get into a cab, and the door of the restaurant swings open and a waiter comes out holding a small package, a small sort of aluminum foil package in the shape of a swan. And he says, "Your gâteau," to the people who are trying to get away. And for reasons having to do, I think, with character, Sasha and her father totally fell apart in laughter over that moment. The mother thought it was silly. The brother didn't get it. And they would use it with each other for weeks. They would say, "Your gâteau," and it was, you know, a sure way to get the other one to crack up. But it was very much just the two of them. It was some kind of code between them that excluded the other members of the family.
And it is, again, to me at least, in those details that's what rings true to a reader. Obviously, in your life, my life, whoever's life, they're not going to have a gâteau necessarily moment. But they'll have something. They'll have something that they share with their dad and not their mom, or vice versa, with a sib, whatever.
Right. And also, I think the sort of immortality of certain moments from long, long ago. There are these sort of almost totemic memories that in some way define what it means to be a family. It's, you know, those are the people who remember, you know, the day at the swimming pool when whatever happened.
Ann Pecker, our guest. The collection of stories is called Swim Back to Me. We'll talk about that title, where it comes from, and what it means when we come back. Again, she'll be at the West Coast Live radio program at the ODC Theater tomorrow at 10 o'clock in San Francisco on 17th Street. And Sunday at 6 o'clock, she'll be at Books, Inc. on 4th Street in Berkeley. And when we come back, we'll take your calls as well. If you have a question for the author, Ann Pecker, here's the number if you want to join us. It's 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. You can email us at forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and post your question there. More with Ann Pecker and Swim Back to Me in just a moment. This is Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Ann Pecker is our guest this hour. Her new collection of stories is called Swim Back to Me. Let me ask you about that title. It comes up in a very intense, powerful story called Molten. That's about a mother's grief over the loss of a teenage boy. And before we get to the title itself, or where Swim Back to Me came from. You use music a lot in that story, rock lyrics. This mother keeps going back to her dead son's room and listening to the rock music that her son listened to. Where did you do a lot of what 16-year-olds listen to research as part of that? Where did that come from?
No, you know, what's funny is that I had a similarly sort of sudden, deep immersion in a lot of rock and roll music. Shortly before I wrote that story, the reason was very different. I had a student who I think sort of recognized that I was stuck in the music of, you know, my teenage years and or the music that my children were listening to at age 4 or 5. And he started making mixtapes for me. And I was, you know, an avid consumer of his tapes. And so he began making more and more. And, you know, over the space of, I don't know, 8-10 months, I went from, you know, never listening to music in the car to having maybe 30 or 40 cassette tapes with me at any moment. And I would just be popping them in and out of the car stereo and obsessively, compulsively, one of those two, listening to what to me was this, you know, astonishing, exciting variety of music that was really an intense aesthetic experience. And it was my sudden acquaintanceship with that music that I think gave me the structure and plot of the story. Obviously, it didn't create the character.
And how did that idea come to you about the idea of a woman who has gone through what I think for any of us is the worst thing imaginable, the death of a child, and connecting that then to this sort of vivid, harsh, pulsing, physical music?
That's something I really can't answer. I don't know how it came to me. I don't remember. Sometimes I can remember starting a story. I don't remember starting that one. I remember being in the middle of it. And normally I work in silence. But for that story, I had a little tape player in my office, and I was popping the tapes in and out, looking for songs that would fuel her emotions. And
it's a really highly fueled story. I mean, there's a lot of fuel.
It's very intensely felt. It's true. And the story ends up taking all that fuel and sort of lighting a fire. I won't say how. And I'm sure that had something to do with, you know, the nature of rock and roll. There's a place in the story where she thinks about how rock and roll sort of turns you into an instrument and plays you. And that was really, I think, what I felt.
The phrase "swim back to me" comes into that story as a lyric. And it seems so perfect for that story in a way, because it's this, what that character wants more than anything is for that child to come back to her. And when you think of that phrase, "swim back to me," it immediately conjures up this image of kids learning to swim, and that you want a child to swim back to you. And of course, once they swim, they never really do. Is that what appealed to you about that phrase?
Yes, I think so. As a title for the whole book, it was evocative of the fear of having someone leaving and going away, and the sort of terror in that, but the possibility of return. So there was a sort of a darkness and a lightness embodied in the phrase. I didn't know that I was going to title the whole book after that one song until I'd already turned the manuscript in and was playing around with a lot of different things.
Is that an actual lyric, by the way, or is that an invention of yours?
It's an actual song, actually. Yeah. It's a song by a band called the Geraldine Fibbers. It's a great, great song. It's really intense.
There's a lot that you do with a sentence that I wanted to ask you about. I underlined this one sentence, and I think one of the reviewers noted this too. It's hard to actually read this, but I'm gonna try because it's really about a comma, and it's a sentence about a story about called Her Firstborn, about a woman who's lost a child years before and is now pregnant again. And the sentence is that in the end, the husband realizes that he sort of hasn't been thinking about this the right way. And he says, it isn't that Lisa had a baby who died, but rather that she had a baby who died. And it's about the placement of that comma and the importance, I guess, of understanding commas.
Well, yeah, I guess the comma is the external sign that the meaning changes dramatically. It was a way for me to, and I, you know, I didn't plan it. I just got there in the paragraph to sort of encapsulate what had happened to him in the story. You know, a lot of times we talk about epiphanies at the ends of short stories, and it can be a little bit scary to shoot for an epiphany. Sometimes, you know, I had a writer friend who said that the classic epiphany where someone says, "And then I realized for the first time such and such." And he said, "No, you didn't." You have to find some way to make the dawning of a new idea really believable. And at the end of that story, it was important for Dean, the main character, to recognize that there was a new way he could think about his wife's first experience of having a child, which did end up with a baby dying of SIDS,
and the difference is to underline the word baby as opposed to died.
Right. All along, he's thinking, "Oh my God, she had she's got a dead baby," essentially, rather than she's got a baby who later died. He's protecting himself from thinking about the fact that she had the experience of having a living baby until he died. And he's essentially protecting himself from knowing about her loss.
Mm-hmm. Ann Packer, again, our guest. She'll be at the West Coast Live program at the ODC Theater in San Francisco tomorrow at 10, Sunday at BookSync in Berkeley. And if you have a question for Ann Packer, you can join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum at kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and add your comments there. Is it hard to resist saying, "And now here comes the epiphany"? I mean, in journalism writing, there's an old dictum, which is tell them what you're going to tell them, and then tell them what you told them. And in a sense, it seems like that's exactly what you don't do.
Right. I think that if you're going for a subtle experience for the reader, there's that other dictum, which is that less is more.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
There's another sentence I want to ask you about. I wrote down a series of sentences that just I found true and just sharp in the way they were framed. You refer once to in another story about two families, and the phrase that's often used is blended families that have stepchildren involved. And you refer to them on one occasion as one time when they all got together as it was one of the early assemblies of the fledgling nation state.
Yeah, that it occurred to me in some moment of writing that story that two families coming together trying to form a group had a slight flavor of, you know, a new almost political entity.
And I want to also ask about the what to me in many ways is sort of the a key sentence in and it's in that story again called Her Firstborn, which is, and I mentioned it in the introduction, what there is to gain is exactly equal to what there is to lose. Again, this idea that there that you can't have one really without the other.
Right. That's what makes relationships so. I feel like I've been using the word scary in almost every response I've given you today. But relationships are very high stakes because with the attachment that you form to another person, you're also creating the possibility of loss.
Could you have just said it the other way around? It strikes me, just like we were talking before about the comma making a difference, that if you had written it, instead of saying what there is to gain is exactly equal to what there is to lose, if you'd inverted it and said what there is to lose is exactly equal to what there is to gain, that it has a sort of different sense about it and in some ways seems somewhat more hopeful, actually.
You're absolutely right. That's interesting. It's much more optimistic to say it in the inverse way. And I think that the character Dean, again, the man facing fatherhood with a wife who's lost a baby in the past, throughout the story is hovering on the edge of pessimism. He's very afraid about what might happen to their child and also their marriage, because obviously her first marriage, her marriage to the father of her firstborn, didn't last. So I think that I constructed that sentence in the more downbeat way, because for me it represented his sort of terror at that moment before their child is born, knowing that everything could change in ways that would ruin him.
It reminds me of, do you know the play or the movie Shadowlands, the C.S. Lewis story? It's the story of C.S. Lewis's late in life love affair that was a movie with Anthony Hopkins and Deborah Winger. But the Deborah Winger character has cancer and will die at some point. And she says to him at one point, you know, the happiness now is part of the pain that will come. That's the deal. And at the end of the play, he says it the other way around. The pain now is part of the happiness then. That's the deal. But it makes this point about how you really can't have one without the other. And maybe it matters whether you invert the sentence one way or the other. I don't know. But the point, I guess, is that sense that that's the deal.
Yeah, that's the deal. It's what we're living for, and it can vanish at any time.
How hard was it for you to? Is it harder to write a collection of stories like this than a novel? It would seem to me like with a novel, you'd have sort of like momentum, like one chapter. It would be like a relay race, you know, that the baton is handed from one chapter to the next, and you can kind of build up a sort of momentum. Whereas here, you're stopping and starting a lot.
That's exactly right. You're stopping and starting a lot. And my process with writing these stories for the first several years was that it was what I was doing in between drafts of my novels. So there was a lot of shifting gears. And as I was writing the novels, they were primary for me. So, for example, I might finish a draft of a novel and ask for feedback from my writer's group, and then I would have, you know, a month or so, and I would turn to a story. But when I got the novel manuscript backed, I would set the story aside no matter sort of what point I was at with it. It got easier once I was really only working on this book, because I would stay with a story for a lot longer. At the same time,
because you wrote this book, came and went as you were working on other.
Right. I wrote the first of these stories, which is Her Firstborn, in I think 97 or so, And then the others came along in breaks in between the two novels. But when I was done with the second novel, this was going to be the next book I was working on, and I focused in a more extended way on each story. That said, writing a novel is a completely different experience from writing a short story. You are living inside its footprint. There are a lot of rooms to wander through when you're writing a novel, and when you're writing a short story, maybe you're in a studio apartment or something. It's a smaller structure.
Do you like one better than the other? Do you find yourself drawn to one form more than the other?
No, I don't really.
Do you want to go back to writing a novel after this?
I will go back to writing a novel. I should say I am writing a novel. At least I think I am. I when I started Walk for Mankind back in the early days when I thought that the narrator was a girl, I actually thought that it might end up being a novel. And it's not always the case that you immediately know what form something's going to take. But what I'm working on now, I'm pretty sure will be a novel.
When you said a moment ago that you showed this to a draft to your writer's group, I'm interested in that. Do you like getting that sort of feedback? Do you find it helpful? I know sometimes when I write something or if I'm working on a television story and there's a screening, I'm not sure I really want the feedback that I'm going to get. In fact, in many ways, I just do not. Thank you very much. So, I mean, do you invite that? Do you find that useful?
Oh, incredibly useful. Absolutely. I know I want to do multiple drafts of everything I write. And essentially, I define a draft as I think I'm finished, but I know I'm not finished. And I hand it over to my writers group, and they help me see what's there. It's not so much that people say, you know, you need to go do X, Y, and Z, and I go and do X, Y, and Z. They talk about it. They help me see what I've done. They raise questions about what the reader might need to make sense of what I'm doing, what the reader could do without. And then I go back and, you know, sort of play the tapes of the conversation I had with them and kind of go back to the beginning and start again. And that'll happen, you know, five or six times in the course of writing a single story or novel.
You come from a writerly family. Your mom ran the creative writing program at Stanford. Your brother, George, is a writer for The New Yorker. Do you share it with them, or is that sort of where you draw the line in terms of whose feedback you want?
I don't read for them much or go to them for feedback. I really like being in a writer's group. We happen to all be very good friends as well, but having the same people who you talk about issues of, you know, narrative, point of view, voice, all that kind of craft stuff that writers talk about. Over the years, we've built up a vocabulary, a shorthand, and just an enormous amount of support for what each other is doing.
And trust, I would think.
Oh, yeah, and trust. And so it's great to go back to that that same group with new work and have them say, oh, I see what you're doing here. It's sort of like what you did in The Dive from Clausen's Pier, but I think you've taken one of the forms of that novel and, you know, done this with it in a story, or you've really moved your exploration of such and such a theme forward with this. So it's just extraordinarily helpful.
How do you know when you're done if you write that many drafts?
Well, the answer I usually give to that question is when you start changing words or punctuation and then changing them back, that's kind of a sign. It's a feeling, you know. I think what I say to myself is sort of, you know, well, I've figured this out. I've learned what it is I wanted to do. I feel like I've done it. I think I want to do something else now.
I'm sure you get asked this a lot, but I'm still curious about how you answer, which is whether or not there are particular stories within this collection that are closer to you and whether or not there are characters that are closer to you, that mean more to you.
It's not really like that. At any moment in the writing of a collection like this, whatever I'm working on at that moment sort of means the most to me because I'm engaged with the questions that it raises. And in terms of the characters, for me, the characters, and this is, I always feel bad saying this to readers because I feel like it sort of pops the balloon in some way. They're a collection of sentences, and I'm trying to get the sentences right.
You write a lot about the Bay Area, although The Dive from Clausen's Pier was set largely in Madison, Wisconsin, and New York. But your last novel, your first stories, mostly about Northern California, Mendocino, this book, all set here. Reminds me of someone like Ann Tyler, who writes always about Baltimore and those environs. Do you want to stay here? I mean, is that where you think you will always write?
I have no idea. I didn't set out to make this book a California book, a Bay Area book, but it kind of just worked out that way. I think I understand the way I use setting in this way, which is that I tend to set my work in the place I've lived fairly recently. So The Dive from Clausen's Pier was set in Madison and New York, and I had been living in both of those places at some point not so long before I wrote that book.
And it's a way of getting the details, right? I mean, you've been closest observing of those places.
Yeah, and those scenes they're sort of stationed at the optimal place in my mind to draw on. But I've now been back in the Bay Area for 16 years. And so if, for example, 4 years previous is the right amount of time for to provide a setting, then 4 years previous is the Bay Area. And 4 years before that was the Bay Area. And 4 years from now, unless I make a move I am really not anticipating making, it'll be the same.
Also allows you to make observations. This was one of my favorites where you write in one of the stories, her parents had chosen to live in Palo Alto over Atherton or Woodside because they wanted her to learn about the real world.
Yeah. That's sort of inside baseball, I think, for Bay Area readers.
What's next? You said you're starting to work on a novel. What shape is it taking? What topics? What kind of characters?
It's a little early for me to go into much detail. I'm not really a superstitious person, but I have the experience that if you talk about something too much too soon, the energy dissipates, or you hear what you're saying and you may have an early attack of second guessing yourself.
Well, let me ask it a different way then. Are there things you want to write about that you feel are kind of bubbling around inside you, even if you don't know what exactly form or shape they'll take?
What I have right now is a group of characters and a setting, which I don't mind saying right now, seems to be mostly Portola Valley. Go figure. These characters have been in my mind for only about 6 months or a year, except for one of them, who I think I began to conceive of maybe 4 or 5 years ago. And one of the challenges in what I'm doing right now is that this original character from 4 or 5 years ago, I've brought him forward into this new work, and I'm not really sure it's the same guy. So part of what I'm doing is trying to explore that.
Just got an email in from Robert who wants to know whether or not you've ever written nonfiction, and if so, how you balance it with writing fiction, and does one help or hinder the other?
I've written short, sort of personal essays. I've had a piece in Vogue, Real Simple. I've got another one coming up in the June issue of Real Simple. It's much more occasional. I tend to write something like that when I get approached by a magazine. The personal essay in which one draws on one's own experience is an awkward form for me because as soon as I start doing it, I want to change things to to make it have a better story. And so I really have to sort of balance my fictional tendencies with the need to tell it straight in some way.
That's such an interesting comment because I think of your writing as being intensely personal in that you so often focus on, you know, the really important, personal, painful, loving parts of life. But it isn't what Ann Packer writing about Ann Packer.
No, or in some way it's Ann Packer able to write way more honestly about Ann Packer by changing things, changing the details and the names.
Ann Packer, the new collection again is called Swim Back to Me. She will be at the ODC Theater for the radio show West Coast Live tomorrow in San Francisco at 10, Sunday, April the 17th at Berkeley Books, Inc. on 4th Street, and then Thursday next week in Santa Cruz at the Bookshop in Santa Cruz. That's on Pacific Avenue in Santa Cruz, all coming up in the next week or so. Anne, really a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
It's a terrific book, Swim Back to Me. Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory and Tina Lorberg. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Danny Bringer and Howard Gelman were our engineers today. Raul Ramirez is our executive producer. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.